Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. And my guest today is Fern Levitt, the director of Sled Dogs, a documentary that provides a behind-the-scenes examination of the Iditarod Trail Sled Race, the 1,000-mile, 9-day event in Alaska, as well as commercial operations in Canada and the U.S. that offer opportunities for recreational dog sledding. Let's just say it's not a pretty picture. If you were made uneasy by pondering the rigors of the Iditarod, it may be well worse than you thought. There's lots more ugliness for those dogs behind the race itself, in the same way that the dogs who work for the commercial operations in Canada and the U.S. that provide opportunities for recreational dog sledding. For starters, they live outside, tethered on short change, virtually 24/7. Levitt doesn't pretend to present an even-handed view of the sled dog world, for which sled dogs has generated criticism and controversy. We'll hear how she decided on that approach, the impetus for making the film, U.S. screenings of sled dogs, and more when I speak with Fern Levitt in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll also speak with Don Goldstein of Greyhound Rescue Adoption of Tampa Bay, or GREAT, and the Talking Animals official Greyhound correspondent about a surprising decision made last week by Florida gambling regulators that halts Greyhound racing at a Miami dog track, and whether that decision may have broader implications for dog racing in Florida, where the preponderance of U.S. tracks still operating are located. Lastly, I want to pay my respects to Snooty, the world's oldest manatee living in captivity, who had been residing in Bradenton, just down the road a piece, and who turned 69 on Friday and then, very sadly, died later in the same weekend. All who knew Snooty loved Snooty, an unusually friendly, outgoing manatee, so rest in peace, sweet Snooty. Right now, let's get to Fern Levitt and her film, Sled Dogs, with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Fern Levitt on Talking Animals. Good morning, Fern.
Good morning, Doug. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals. So before we discuss various aspects of the film, I thought we'd talk for a moment about what I guess I'm going to call sled dog culture. For example, I spent most of my life in Southern California before winding up here in Florida. So while I came to the movie quite aware of the Iditarod, I was not really familiar with businesses that have sled dogs that folks can use recreationally for a day of mushing. So I'm going to guess that more than a few people listening, wherever they are, frankly, are kind of in the same boat. So can you describe how those businesses work from the standpoint of both the patrons and the dogs?
Well, sure. I mean, why I made this film is I went dog sledding. I went dog sledding in Northern Ontario, and it was always painted as being, and the photos I saw were happy dogs pulling sled through winter wonderland. And I thought, oh my God, that's so much fun. I mean, I love dogs and I love the great outdoors. And this would be a wonderful adventure for me and my husband to go on. And I had no idea of, you know, the circumstances and where and how these dogs live. So after we went on the sled ride, I went looking for the dogs, because you come in, the sled is ready for you, you don't see where the dogs live. So I went looking for them down the road, and when I found them, I was shocked, to put it mildly, to see 300 dogs, all in chains, hooked up to these blue plastic barrels as their only shelter, and it was literally a virtual concentration camp of dogs. And I mean, they were skinny, and they were running in circles on their chains, and I didn't even think this was legal to keep a dog chained like that. And what I found out is that this is pervasive in the commercial sled dog industry. They're doing it to make money. I mean, you know, these aren't dog sanctuaries. They're using these dogs to make money. And in order to make money, you have to have 50, 100, 200 dogs. And it's easier to keep these dogs on chains than to allow them to run freely. So that's the life they lead. At 6 months old, they're put on a chain for the rest of their lives. And that's how they live until the day they die or horribly are shot, which is legal in both our countries.
Well, of course, we're going to delve into all that a good deal more here over the time of our conversation. But just to back up for a sec, because this was obviously pivotal to launching on the path to make the film and find out and research everything you did prior to doing so. So why do you think you had that kind of impulse to, once you finished the sledding, to go back and try to check out where the dogs were. What do you think was going on?
I wanted to play with the puppies.
Okay.
I mean, it was purely naive, you know. I did not suspect a thing. And I wanted to go, and I asked if there were puppies there, and they said yes, and I wanted to go back and play with the puppies. And so I had no idea what I was about to walk into. And then when I saw what I saw, I felt horrible. How could I participate in such a thing like this? So I asked the owner if I could take a dog home, and he said to me, which was completely spontaneous, and he said to me, well, 30 are about to be retired, and if we don't find homes for them, we call them. So you could take one or you could take 30. Again, I didn't even know this was legal. I didn't know that the entire thing was legal, that you can keep your dogs on chains their entire life and shoot them when they're no longer necessary. And so we took home one of the dogs. His name was Slater. And his eyes were vacant. He had lived on that chain since he was 6 months old. He was 9 years old. And he didn't do any of the things that dogs normally do. He was afraid of human touch. He didn't play with other dogs. He didn't chase a squirrel. He didn't chase after a ball. And that's because he was deprived. I mean, living on a chain his whole life, he was deprived, and he never learned how to be a dog. So I loved him. I really loved him, and I decided that I would make every day count as three because of what he had gone through, because of us humans. And it broke my heart. And then, you know, I'm a journalist, and then I decided I better find out if this is an anomaly. Did I fall into something that was illegal, or is this pervasive? And very shortly after we rescued Slater, it came out in the national newspaper, I think even international newspaper, that 100 dogs were killed at Whistler, B.C., because they were losing business. So they lost 100 dogs, and the government came out and said, well, it's an anomaly. And I knew enough by then that they were lying. In fact, what I had witnessed and what happened in Whistler was, in fact, pervasive amongst the entire industry. So as a filmmaker and someone who loves dogs, loves animals, I knew that the public, if they knew what was really going on behind the sled dog industry, they would be as outraged as I was.
For sure. And I guess one of the many things that's interesting about how you got launched on this journey is when you did have that impulse and you say, hey, I just wanted to play with the puppies. But I just find it interesting that the people running that business that you had gone sledding at were okay with you doubling back to see the horrific conditions under which these dogs were living. It seems like it'd be in their best interest just for you, but generally for word of mouth and just overall keeping the customers coming, to not have you have a glance at how those dogs were kept and treated.
Yeah, you know what? The most interesting thing is that I learned a lot as I was, you know, the 2 or 3 years that I was making this film, I learned a lot about human nature, which is interesting because I've made over 20 documentaries, but I think I learned more about us as humans making this film than I ever have before. And we have a very good way, maybe it's cognitive dissonance, I don't know what it is, of talking ourselves into things. And to believing, I mean, the narrative or the very false narrative about these dogs is that they're different, that sled dogs are different than other dogs, and therefore they can be treated differently. And that, you know, they would never do this to pet dogs, but these are working dogs. And therefore, you know, they can keep them chained all day because this is their working dogs, so therefore they're different. Mm. And they lose, you know, when you've got so many dogs. I mean, I have a very close relationship with my dog. He's everything to me. But it's just him and, you know, we just have one dog. And if you have 20, 30, 40, 100, 300 dogs, they just become commodities. They easily lose their individuality because you're so busy, you know, looking, you know, taking care of them, you know, making sure that you're making a profit, that they lose their individuality. And we have a good way of talking ourselves into things that just aren't true.
Well, and it sounds like along those lines that the proprietor of your operation and perhaps many others, because of that perspective of these dogs are different and all that goes with that. They didn't really even know or to feel like sort of embarrassed or like protective of, hey, I don't want these people to see how these dogs live and that they are chained the rest of the time and they have a white plastic kind of a glorified bucket to live in. It almost seems like by that time, nothing is sort of normal, so that you'd think they would do everything they could to keep you and everyone else away from that. But I guess they've gotten to the point where it's like, well, this is kind of a different deal. These are sled dogs, so yeah.
Well, most of these places, where they keep the dogs, they're mostly hidden from public awareness. You know, you come there and the sled is there and the dogs are there, so the dog yards are hidden away. So most people don't see it. There are some places that are right in front of you, but most of the places are hidden away. And I guess they're just so, because, you know, when I was making this film, I was asking very clear questions. Many towns, municipalities, cities throughout North America have anti-chaining legislation. Toronto, in fact, just enacted one very, very, very just recently, because we realize that the chaining of any animal, you know, any species is cruel and inhumane. But we also recognize that the continual chaining of dogs is cruel because it goes against their very nature of, you know, their need to run, to be part of a pack, to play with other dogs, to be with us. We're their family. And when I would say to them, you know, it's been proven, scientifically proven, that these dogs are, that they're pack animals and they need freedom, they would say that they're sentient beings, that dogs are sentient beings. And when I would say that to them, they would just repeat the same kind of false narrative. Well, they're different. Sled dogs are different, so therefore they can be treated differently. It didn't matter what I said to them. They kept repeating that same narrative because they had a financial stake in it. So they needed to believe it.
Yeah, and it seems like a companion piece of philosophy, if that's the right word, was this thing that recurs throughout your film about they're like special athletes.
Yeah.
And so therefore, hey, they can be treated this way and they can be trained this way and they can be chained up pretty much all day and night because they're sort of in a special class, which
isn't true.
Yeah, no,
dogs are dogs. And
right,
they have the same. They're not. You know, again, a false narrative, a false label that we humans gave these dogs. They're not canine athletes. They're dogs, and they were never meant to run 1,000 miles, 100 miles a day, 4 marathons a day. And I showed my documentary to a group of veterinarians. And what they saw, you know, I could see that too, but I wanted to get professional feedback, is as they're watching them race 1,000 miles, they were horrified with what they saw. They said these dogs are severely dehydrated, completely depleted, lame, sick, sore, depressed. They're not canine athletes. They're just dogs, and they're suffering horribly from having to race this 1,000 miles to race.
Well, I want to get into that for sure in a moment,
sorry.
Too. But but I guess as we're talking about some of this and again, how you discovered the situation and ended up adopting Slater, I mean, before your film, was the horrific life of sled dogs kind of a well-kept secret even amongst customers of these businesses?
Yes, it was a well-kept secret.
Yeah.
It was a well-kept secret. I mean, they've done a very good job. The sled dog community has done a very good job of pulling the wool over our eyes. And again, when you look at their web pages, you don't see the behind the scenes. You don't see the dogs sitting in chains. You see them running through the forest. And I mean, when they're let off the chains and they're running through the forest, you see, you know, they finally have some freedom. So they're excited and happy.
They look a little bit like dogs at that point.
Yeah, they look like dogs. I mean, my dog loves to run through the forest too, but he's not on a chain. And but he also loves to lie in bed with us at night and have his tummy scratched, which these dogs will never get. You never see what I saw. And we are the first documentary that went behind the scenes of sled dog operations, including the Iditarod, and exposed what's really going on, because we just don't know. And all of us, including myself, and I could, you know, I could get really upset with myself for not thinking about, you know, how the dogs were treated before I went dog sledding. But I went along with the narrative, too, that these were happy dogs pulling sleds and well-loved and well-looked after. And I had no reason not to believe that. So I did, until I saw the truth.
Well, let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Fern Levitt, director of Sled Dogs, a documentary that provides a behind-the-scenes examination of the Iditarod Trail sled dog race and commercial operations in both Canada and the U.S. that offer opportunities for recreational dog sledding. If you'd like to ask Fern a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So, Fern, it seems like your path into making this film, as we've established, was that personal experience with one of those sledding companies and then starting to ask questions and then the revelations about the horrible Whistler story. So given that those were sort of the catalyst, it sounds like, as you were conceiving the film, when did you also start focusing on the Iditarod? As when did that sort of enter the picture, literally, I guess?
Well, you know, I've been doing films for a long time, and I used to do a lot of work for History Television, so I know how critically important research is. It's everything. And I knew that I was taking on a subject that never had been exposed before. So I really, with any subject that I take on, I learn as much about it as I possibly can. I speak to the experts. I do my research. And, of course, the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest, that's the Canadian version of the Iditarod, but I couldn't put both in.
Yeah.
You know, the Iditarod is a famous race. It's called the Last Great Race. It's been going on to the 1970s. And I started, you know, I perked up when I started listening to this and thinking just logically, oh, my God, racing these dogs for 10 days, 1,000 miles, this doesn't make sense. So I started researching it, and that's when I found out what was really going on. And when people found out what I was doing, they would, you know, former mushers would contact me and say, I need to tell you what's going on underneath the surface. And it's not the last great race. It's the race of death. And so I knew that I had to include that as well, because that's another false narrative, horrific narrative, that these are canine athletes, super athletes is what they're called. And they love what they do, and they're made, you know, to race this, and it's a great celebration of man and woman and dog and really honoring the past legacy of when these dogs in 1925 brought this serum to this town that was dying of this illness. And it's nothing. It's nothing like how it originated, where those dogs were praised as heroes. And now it's become a great, big, wealthy sporting event where somewhere a musher, if he or she wins the race, can make a great deal of money and become celebrities in their town.
So I guess this accounts for the narrative of the movie is really driven by four interwoven storylines. So we have the puppy being trained as a sled dog in Ontario. We have this novice musher, Patrick, preparing for the Iditarod. We have the dog sledding, in this case in Snowmass, Colorado, which we'll come back to, I guess, in more detail in a sec. And then the aftermath of the Whistler sled dog tragedy that we've touched on a couple times already. And I guess for you as a filmmaker, I guess it was sort of one of those, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts scenario as far as those four stories and some other things too, telling the overall story and a bigger story than if you only had two or three of those.
Right. I wanted people to see. I wanted people to really understand. It was very important to me. This wasn't just making a film for me. This was way more than this. I mean, dogs are our best friends, and they literally are our best friends, and they do so much for us. You know, they're the best friends for children with autism, best, you know, the eyes for the blind, you know, for people who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And just for us, they give us unconditional love. And I know how special they are. I mean, so many of us know how special they are and what a gift they are. And to see them used and abused this way, it broke my heart, really broke my heart. And to see the end result of my own dog, Slater, living at the end of the chain and what he had suffered so somebody can make a buck also was heartbreaking. So for me, this is so much more than a film. I believe that we are a dog-loving, well, we are. We're a dog-loving nation. And if people knew what was really going on behind the scenes and how the dogs live and are treated, there would be outrage and calls to stop this. And they would no longer be supported. And that's why I made the film. I made the film to save these dogs, to break their chains, and get them into loving homes where they belong. Stop this.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, regarding the four storylines, just as a viewer coming to a lot of this without much, like I say, knowledge or experience, I found all the storylines disturbing. Even if you're sort of a layperson, you have at least vague awareness of the Iditarod, and you think, well, that that doesn't seem right for the dogs. Or it seems, even if you don't know all the details, it just seems like, wow, that seems like kind of a grueling thing. But as your film points out, yeah, it is 1,000 miles. It is 9, 10 days, depending on how it goes. But you really see, woving into that part of the film, the storyline of Patrick. And again, first time musher, but whether first time or not, you talk with other people who've got much more experience, and really the physical elements and breakdowns really that happen to those dogs along the way, even though they're each breast up is staffed with veterinarians and stuff, but the ailments are pretty jarring.
And that was also very difficult too, because the veterinarians took an oath to, when they graduate or before they graduate, they take an oath to protect these dogs. And it was very obvious to us, very obvious to the vets that watched this film, that these dogs were suffering and suffering terribly. I mean, bleeding ulcers is one-third of all dogs are dropped because of bleeding ulcers, which is caused by enormous stress of running all these miles. And, you know, and we see that in the film. We see a dog with blood all over him, and yet he wasn't taken off. And, you know, I guess, I don't know what happens. Those mushers need those dogs to keep running. So despite the fact that they're dehydrated, exhausted, lame, they keep them going. And the important thing that people need to realize is that this is a lottery. If you win, you can make a great deal of money. You can have a great deal of status because you're considered a hero. So they breed a lot of puppies. They breed and breed and breed and breed and breed. And then if the puppies don't measure up or the dogs don't measure up, the dogs are killed. The puppies are killed because it is legal in this country, in Canada and North America. Dogs are still considered nothing more than property, which I was shocked at. And it is legal to kill your dog humanely, as you know, as they say, humanely, which is taking a gun and shooting it between its eyes. So I question whether that's humane. And it's legal to do this. And they're not recognized as sentient beings, which they are. So people get involved in winning the race and trying to win the race and become a champion. And you can only do that if you have the very best dogs. So there's a lot of breeding going on, and there's a lot of killing going on before the race, after the race. I mean, it's already been noted and accepted, you know, that 150 dogs have died racing the Iditarod. 150 dogs. Well, there's lots. Well, that's horrendous in itself. But there's thousands more that are not recorded because there would be outrage if they let that out. That was what I was told about by several witnesses who used to work with these mushers and could no longer live with themselves. Not only did the mushers tell me, but I had vets call me too that couldn't live with themselves and had to tell me what they witnessed. So it's horrendous.
Yeah,
I cannot believe that this is allowed in countries progressive countries such as ours.
Right. Now, you've made a reference a couple times to what awaits the winner and all the fame and fortune. So what does someone who wins the Iditarod, what do they stand to take home if they're the victor of that year's race?
Well, their puppies are worth a lot of money, a deal of money. If they're the winners, their puppies are worth a great deal of money. They get about $100,000 of cash. And then also they now can get all kinds of endorsements. I mean, the Iditarod is a huge sporting event. If you win, you know, the media's there, you get your name in the papers, you get interviewed, you're considered a hero. So you can do endorsements. The man that won this year, Mitch Seaway, I mean, I filmed at his place. He lives in a mansion. You know, it's almost, I mean, I'm laughing, but it's not funny. It reminded me of a slave plantation, to be quite honest, because there he is living in this mansion, and then you see these hundreds of dogs all in plastic barrels with, and they had rocks. It was disgusting. They had rocks inside these plastic barrels, so they didn't even have straw for comfort. And so there's a great deal of money to be won. Yes, it's like winning a lottery. The chances of that are being struck by lightning, but that doesn't stop people from trying.
Yeah, they figure just like people who play the lottery, hey, somebody's got to win.
Yeah, someone's got to win.
Right.
Let it be me.
Yeah.
It becomes about winning. It doesn't become about the dogs. It becomes about winning. I mean, you know, humans, we can be greedy. And we're hoping to win and hoping for the status and this prestige, we don't think about the dogs. Even Patrick. I mean, I chose Patrick in my film because he's a decent person, and he is like all of us. And even, and he did care about the dogs, but even his desire to win, when that one dog, he had one dog in the film that the vet said to him, he's sick and he should be dropped. Well, Patrick continued with that dog. So even his great instinct of protecting the dog, it was still more important for him to continue the race.
Yeah, we should point out that Patrick is the novice rusher whose story we track in Sled Dogs.
Right.
So
and
along those lines, for a director makes endless choices over the course of a film, obviously, and you've made it clear that you really sought to expose some of the awful things about the whole sled dog culture and world and all these operations and get some of those sled dogs off the chains and into homes. So in this way, it's sort of making those choices and just your own passion that comes through loud and clear as we're talking here. This feels more like advocacy filmmaking. And would that be a reasonable observation? Or
this is a documentary. I want to be very clear about that because people said, oh, it's very one-sided. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I'm proud of that. And what we do is we document what's in front of us. So what you see is we just pointed the camera and we just filmed. That's all we did. We filmed a six-month-old puppy being put on a chain for the first time and what that was like for that puppy, which hopefully people will watch the film and see for themselves how horrific that was. And we just took our cameras and filmed the places where these dogs live and what it's like for them to live on chains their whole lives. So for me, did I become an advocate? Of course I did, because of the horror that I experienced during the 2 years of making this film. It's just wrong. But as a film, it's a documentary. We just set up our cameras and we just filmed. As you know, in part of my film, one of the places that we filmed at, there was a dog that was dead. We came to one of the places that we filmed, and the dog was dead. And that's typical. When I saw that, I had read a great deal of that the dogs, when it's very cold outside or very hot outside, the dogs really suffer, and some of them end up being frozen to death. And I came upon this dog commercial enterprise, and we were looking around and waiting to film, and I saw a dog lying on the ground, and I went up to it, and it was dead. It had frozen through the night.
Yeah.
And that's typical of what goes on.
Yeah, well, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, there's an actual interview underway with either the trainer or proprietor of that place, and either you or someone off camera mentions that it appears that a dog is down or dead, and they kind of abandon the interview quickly and run over, and sure enough,
the dog discovered, was dead.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
it had frozen through the night.
So
and
it's,
I had read about that. I had read that this happens all the time, that these dogs suffer from hypothermia, they suffer from heat stroke. They're from the months, for many of these places, from the months of, let's say, from May to October, when there isn't snow, when the dogs aren't racing, they just sit there. They just sit there. The place that we rescued, Slater, Chalkpaw, the dogs just sat there from the end of May, from May to October. Somebody comes once or twice a day, gives them food, cleans up, and that's it. And then they just sit there. And this goes against their very nature of needing to be part of a pack and running freely. I mean, they're just sitting on chains. I mean, can you imagine that? And that's the reality. And the other thing I need to point out, for many of these dogs, for mostly all these dogs that are finally rescued, they're damaged physically and psychologically. They're damaged. They're frightened, similar to my dog, Slater. They're frightened. They don't know how to play with other dogs. It takes them a long time, and maybe never, to come out of it. But then what do you expect from any species that spends the rest of their life on a chain?
Yeah.
So for people to say these are canine athletes and that they're different from other dogs, first of all, they're canine athletes. What are they doing living their lives on a chain? And second of all, for them to say that they're different from other dogs, that's not true. They're dogs, and they suffer. And the end result of life on chain is that these dogs, the light is out of their eyes, and it takes them a long time, if ever, to really come back.
Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Fern Levitt, director of Sled Dogs, a documentary that has its premiere in New York this Friday, July 28th, and screens at numerous theaters across the country on August 8th. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So coming back to your thing about property. I mean, it seems like there are certain themes that emerge over the course of the film. And as we see repeatedly in other situations, an obstacle for animal welfare is the so-called property problem. And that is the animals are considered property. So in every aspect of your film, really in each of the four storylines, it's hard not to be reminded that these dogs are considered property and as such can be treated pretty much as those various folks see fit. Ultimately, of course, I guess are limits, but it would appear that it takes some pretty extreme circumstances to surface those limits. And again, no better, I guess, or more striking example than the Whistler tragedy. Yeah. Can you just at least briefly address what happened there and some of the ripple effects from that horror?
Well, okay, what happened with Whistler is there was a dog sled company, and they had, in Whistler, B.C., and they had bred more dogs, more puppies, because the Winter Olympics was in Vancouver in 2010 and in Whistler. So they bred a great deal more puppies than what was normally needed. And then at the end of the Olympics and the tourists went home, they had all these excess dogs. And let's face it, for us that have dogs, they cost money. I mean, you know, there's vet bills and food bills, but it's our pleasure because they're part of our family. But for them, when this becomes a commercial venture, it's about the bottom line and meeting the bottom line. And they had all these dogs, and they weren't making money. In fact, they were losing the money. And so it's legal in Canada and the United States and, unfortunately, other countries in the world to shoot your dog. That's legal. And as long as it's done, as I said, humanely, which is taking a shotgun and putting it through its eyes, the dogs are killed instantly. Now, personally, I find there's nothing humane about that. I think it's horrible. But anyway, so what happened is that the manager of this whistling dog company decided that he had to call 100 dogs, kill 100 dogs in order to, make ends meet. And so it wasn't that he was finally arrested for animal abuse. It wasn't because he shot the dogs. It's because he missed. And many times, as he was trying to shoot the dogs, he missed and didn't shoot them between their eyes and had to end up knifing some of them. I mean, it gets grotesque. So he was arrested for animal abuse because they were able to prove that the dogs did suffer and suffer terribly before they died. And so he was arrested on that. And the end result of that is that he was he was not imprisoned. He was fined, I think, about $1,000 and was put on probation and was told he could not have a dog for 3 years. Today, this happened in 2011, today he could open up another dog sled company.
Yeah.
And in fact, he does have it. He didn't open up another dog sled company, but he could own a dog after everything that happened. The BC government allowed him to open up another dog sled company again after his probation. And in fact, what the BC government did, which was horrendous, which we revealed in the film, is they put together, there was obviously outrage by dog-loving people and other people who were horrified by what happened, and there was protests. And so the BC government said that they would bring in new legislation to help protect these dogs. Well, the things that they asked for, the Humane Society asked for, is that dogs, number one, to end the commercial dog sled industry, which didn't happen, because unfortunately with government, business is first, but to at least find a way of not chaining those dogs and certainly not killing those dogs. Well, the BC government didn't give in to that, and they allowed chaining to continue. And then within those recommendations were actual diagrams on how to kill your dog. Actual diagram given by the BC government on how to shoot your dog between its eyes. Because if Bob Fawcett, the person that killed the 100 dogs, had killed the dogs properly, he never would have been arrested because it's legal.
There were so many points along the way where I thought, oh my God, this is, you just can't think you can be shaken up again. And then a few minutes later is this. And that reminds me back to the property thing, which is kind of all this that we're discussing really unfortunately falls under. But just another much tinier detail, but also that really spooked me, was someone is talking about sled dogs that are born with black pads are considered tougher, so they're okay. But if they're born with white pads, they'll likely be killed right off the bat.
Yeah.
I mean,
these aren't beloved, right? And I really want your listeners to understand this is not a Canadian issue. This is a North American issue. The United States has more dog sled companies than I think any other commercial dog sled enterprises than any other country in the world. And what happened in Whistler happens in your country, too. I filmed as well in Aspen, Colorado, Snowmass, Colorado.
Yeah.
And it was a killing field there, too. So that was one of the stories that I followed. But it's true. People need to understand, what I'm grateful for and what I'm hopeful for is that we're getting to the point where we are recognizing that animals are important and should be protected, and using them for entertainment, as they did in circuses, or for profit. It goes against their welfare. Their welfare is not protected if animals are used for entertainment and profit. And it's very exciting to see circuses fall and SeaWorld, people not supporting SeaWorld anymore. That's exciting. That's why I made this film, because I really believe there's so many of us that love these animals and realize how important and precious they are, that if they knew what was really going on, they would no longer support it either. And again, my goal was to break the chains and get them into homes. But it becomes greed, unfortunately, takes over, and that becomes the goal. So if the puppies in the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest don't measure up, if they're not going to do what the mushers need them to do, then they kill them. Because if they're not making money, they're costing money.
And now, for some time, they get killed in a government-mandated way.
Yeah, government. Yeah. In Alaska, sled dogs don't even have the same status as pet dogs. They're considered livestock. So it makes it very easy for the mushers to abuse them in any way that they can and not get arrested for that.
So you touched on SeaWorld, and let me say, one of our emailers, this won't be the first or last time there's parallel drama, says, hopefully our film will bring about change like Blackfish did for orcas at SeaWorld.
So, I hope so. That's the goal, for sure.
Yeah. And let me also let folks know, we're speaking with Fern Levitt. We're in the last moment or two. She's the director of the documentary Sled Dogs, which has its premiere in New York this Friday and screens at numerous theaters across the country on August 8th. The website is sleddogsfilm.com, so it lists all the screenings everywhere for August 8th. There's a huge number of that happening that day in particular. So, Fern, one impact we've seen is that Wells Fargo has pulled its sponsorship of the Iditarod. I mean, what else do you hope that the film achieves? I mean, beyond obviously the awareness, which I think as people lay their eyes on this film, they're going to be pretty blown away, especially if they didn't have really much exposure to this culture, as in my case. What are some other outcomes that would constitute a success for you?
Oh, my God. First of all, I want to thank you so much for talking to me and letting me be on your show, because I know that without publicity, without awareness, then I can't help the dogs. So
sure.
I'm really grateful to you for letting me speak and letting the film be known.
My pleasure.
What is my goal?
Well, just not necessarily what is your goal, but what are some specific examples of things that would constitute, okay, this for me makes the film successful? Or I would think right off the bat that Wells Fargo pulled its money from Iditarod, given
and
how
State
much...
State Farm Insurance, too.
Okay, okay.
State Farm Insurance did as well, which
okay.
I'm very grateful to. I'm working very closely, when PETA, the animal welfare organization, found out about the film, we joined forces, and they're helping me in so many ways to help raise awareness, because they have, thousands if not millions of members. And we're working together to make the sponsors of the Iditarod realize what they're really sponsoring, which is not this last great race, but in fact this race of death. So to me, what would be wonderful, of course, is that the sponsors to drop out and the race to end. Or if they're going to keep racing, that humans should do it themselves on snowmobiles or skis or whatever, but not use these dogs. And that people would realize what goes on behind. Look at what goes on behind sled dog operations and not support it. I mean, the question is, do we really need to do this? Do we really need to use animals for our entertainment in such a way that their livelihood is compromised? That they're compromised.
Yeah.
That their welfare is compromised.
Right.
I mean, there's so many wonderful ways of enjoying winter, going skiing. There's so many ways of going enjoying winter. One of the best of all is when I take my dog and it's snowing out and he plays in the snow. So rescue a dog and go out. Go take them for a walk and see how they play in the snow. It's the most wonderful thing.
For
we
sure.
need to really think about using animals for entertainment, because 9 times out of 10, if not 10 out of 10, their welfare is being compromised. I'm really hoping it's public awareness. Through public awareness, then there's a chance that these enterprises will not be supported, and hopefully we can, this will end, and we can get these dogs into homes.
Fair enough. Well, this is Fern Levitt. She's the director of Sled Dogs. The website, again, is sleddogsfilm.com. Opens official premiere in New York this Friday. And, again, all kinds of screenings across the country on August 8th. So you can find out more by going to that website. Thank you so much, Fern, for the film
so
and joining us today on Talking Animals. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
In a few moments, I'll speak with Don Goldstein about the notable decision made last week by Florida gambling regulators that certainly affected at least one dog track and may have wider impact on the Florida dog racing scene. Right now, it's time to step into the comedy corner with a new piece from a major Talking Animals favorite, Jim Gaffigan. His new special is airing on Netflix. It's his fifth special, entitled fittingly, Cinco. This is a slice of it called Animal Lover by Jim Gaffigan in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
I do love steak, but it is rather barbaric, right? I mean, we're eating a part of a cow, and I love animals, and I love animal lovers. My favorite are the people that carry around the dog in a bag. Whenever I see that, I always think, what an adorable way to let us know you're crazy. Because they're crazy. They're carrying around an animal that can walk in a bag. They're not going to the vet, they're shopping. That's okay, but if I carry around a canned ham, I'm a weirdo. It'd be one thing if the dog looked happy, but the dog always has a look on his face like, can you believe I'm sitting in a purse? I was part of Mexican royalty. But I get it, I love dogs, and I think it's cute when people dress their dogs up, but how do you have your dog in a jacket and walk by a homeless person? Sorry, I'd help, but I spent all my money on a coat for my animal that's born with a coat. I love cats. Some people don't like cats. Our neighbor has a cat, and she lives in a studio apartment, or as I refer to it, a litter box. One time she asked me, she was like, can you even tell I have a cat? And I was like, no, but I can tell you have a box of turds in your apartment. I'm not sure if that's the same question. We all have the friend with the cat, right? In the small place, you visit them, the cat does their business. You don't really acknowledge it. You just go on with the conversation. What do you want on your pizza? Bleach. Febreze. Can we open a window or knock down a wall? Are my eyes bleeding? How about we throw a diaper on the kitty? But I get it, because I love animals. I think being around animals, there's a healing quality. But I also think we give animals too much credit. Like a dog is man's best friend. I've never seen a dog help someone move. Yes, horses are graceful and elegant until you see them poop standing up. Dolphins are smart. Learn English like Jesus did. For the record, I would never eat a dolphin because I don't like fish. And I know I'll get tweets where people will say, dolphins are mammals, and those are the people I block. Because that's how I deal with criticism.
That was Jim Gaffigan with a piece called Animal Lover, taken from his new special and companion CD called Cinco. Now on to my conversation with Don Goldstein. Indeed, let's welcome Don back to Talking House. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you today?
I'm doing well. And first, I don't know if you were back from your trip. I did thank you on air. You offer all kinds of expertise and assistance on this Greyhound story I wrote for the Washington Post blog. So now that I know you're listening, I can thank you officially. So thank you again.
Happy to help.
So summarize, if you would, this ruling that came down last week.
Well, it's a kind of a good news, bad news story, Duncan. The good news is that one out of the 12 tracks will, at some point in the not-too-distant future, stop racing Greyhounds, and that's great news. The bad news is that it's probably limited just to Flagler. Probably does not have any further application. It's based on three different laws going all the way back to 1980, and the way the three laws work together, it's unlikely that it can spread beyond Miami-Dade and Broward counties.
Right, because as we've learned from you primarily over the years, this is kind of screwy, confounding Florida law that tracks, dog racing tracks, basically have the dog racing in order to have their card rooms, which are obviously where the money is. And in some cases, in this one in particular, slot machines. So if I follow, you're saying this is kind of a weird anomaly, but it doesn't really mean anything for the rest of the tracks.
Right. The only other track it could possibly be affected is Hillendale, and they actually filed with the Department of Business and Professional Regulations, the one that actually allowed this to happen. They filed an objection with them, so it's unlikely that it'll affect them as well. And what it amounts to is that Flagler is going to be allowed to convert from a pari-mutuel betting facility for dogs and go to a pari-mutuel betting facility for highlight. There will be building a fronton on the same footprint, much less of a footprint, of course, as the dog track. So they still fall into the coupled business, where you couple pari-mutuel betting with, in Miami-Dade, both slot machines and card rooms, and the rest of the state just card rooms.
So is there something unique to that track that the regulators made this ruling, and I guess more to the point, if they were inclined, could other tracks say, hey, if that's what it takes, I guess we'll build a fronton?
It would take a change in the law.
Okay.
The 1980 law that this is based on was limited to Miami-Dade and Broward counties.
Oh, I see. So this,
and of course, that predates the coupling. That predates the actual licensing of the card room. So it's really convoluted.
So it's a collision of two different laws that make this very specific to that track.
Right, and add in the 2004 constitutional amendment that allowed facilities in Miami-Dade and Broward counties to add slots, and they're the only ones that had this, provided that the people in Miami-Dade and Broward voted for it, which they did. So nobody else is allowed slots other than those tracks as well. And that's frankly what killed the decoupling or the gaming bill this past year in the Senate, in the conference committee, the House and Senate conference committee, was the problem with slots. Everybody else wants them.
And I guess as we've learned from you and as I learned in the course of reporting that story, these tracks are very much of a mind like, hey, if this guy gets this, I need to get this. I don't want this guy to get this if I can't get this. So it seems like there's very little give and take on the things that would actually make the decoupling, which again would separate the need for dog racing from the other gambling operations.
Yeah, there is no one voice on the industry side. There certainly is on the anti-racing side, but there is not on the pro-racing side. Everybody's out for what they can get for themselves. As Florida State Senator Dana Young said, and I love this, that the Greyhound industry is basically a circular firing squad.
Yeah.
They can't get out of their own way.
Right.
I want to point something out, if I can, Duncan, just
sure.
Slightly off topic, but I was amazed at the similarity between what Vern Levitt presented in the first part of your show with the Greyhound industry, the confinement of the dogs. They're on chains. The Greyhounds are in cages, small cages, and the philosophy of the two industries come back with the same narratives. It was just kind of striking to me.
Yeah, and it's one of the things why I really wanted to speak with her about this. Again, as I made clear, I just didn't really have much exposure to the whole sled dog world. I mean, again, awareness of the Iditarod the way maybe most people would, but even that was far more limited than it probably should have been, as it turns out. But otherwise, we're in Florida. That's, for better or worse, that's where most of the dog racing tracks are, so you're kind of steeped in it. But yeah, once you started hearing what their lives are like, and you see the footage of these, kennels isn't really the right word, because they're outdoors, and these are like plastic overhangs that they're chained, and I was struck by that as well, and that's interesting for you to make that connection. So Don, I think I know the answer to this, but any reason to be hopeful? This sounds like it was really sort of a one-off decision that doesn't really have any broader implications, at least in terms of spurring any hope for folks who would like to see the decoupling and therefore the end of the Greyhound racing, or at least a great reduction in it. So it's just going to be status quo for the time being?
For the time being, but again, this helps to get the word out.
Yeah.
That's the good news, and the good news is that this is one less track. Now we're down. We will be down to 11 out of 18 in the country in Florida. So we're moving in the right direction. That's always positive.
Yeah.
And hopefully the legislature will take another look at it this year. We'll certainly be up there presenting to them.
Right, and we will no doubt speak with you from there, or at least with your reports that you can provide from being up there. So, as always, Don, thank you so much for all your great information and expertise on the Greyhound world.
And thank you, Duncan, for helping to get the word out. It's vital.
All right, thanks again. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, Duncan. Bye-bye.
Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Loray and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., Craig Kopp and John Gilmore preside over executive session. Meanwhile, on this show, well, you know what? I think we might carry this over to next week. I was going to get into the whole Name That Animal Tune Talking Animals feature, but I think we may just hold it over and just carry on with that for next week. So I want to quickly let you know something coming up next month. And that's Friends of Strays is doing a big event at Flying Boat Brewing Company on International Homeless Animals Day. That's Saturday, August 19th. And there's all kinds of cool things. There's going to be microchip clinics at an incredibly reasonable price and other events. And that's at Flying Boat Company Brewing Company in St. Petersburg again on August 19th. You can find out more by going to friendsofstrays.org. So we have just about reached the end of this edition of Talking Animals. We'll be back next Wednesday with another edition. Rob Loray is up next with Radioactivity. Please visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there too. And there are links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and even better yet, me personally, and follow me on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our e-newsletter there to find out about our guests and other things well in advance. Sort of in advance. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond. Community conscious radio, homegrown, handpicked music and news. NPR News is next. Thanks.